To the brightest audience in the country, welcome to another episode of Real Science Friday. I'm Bob Enyart.
And I'm Fred Williams, software engineer and creation speaker.
Fred, we've got the Answers magazine from April to June 2011. This is from Ken Ham's group, and it's a great magazine.
Yeah, many more examples of design and nature. I would think if we did this show once a week for the rest of our lives, we'll never run out of great examples. It just boggles the mind reading this, things that I had no clue of, like this beetle we're going to talk about, and the plants and whatnot.
Yeah, the fire-chasing beetle and how do plants know how to grow up and not down when you bury a seed in the ground. A lot of fun things. And also there's an article in here on the ultimate proof of creation. And I've been reading a book titled The Ultimate Proof of Creation by Dr. Jason Lyle, and he's with Ken Ham's ministry, Answers in Genesis.
Yeah, he used to be a member of Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship. He used to come many
back in the day,
years ago.
And he got his PhD in astrophysics from CU up in Boulder.
That's right.
University of Colorado. So it's a great book, and Lord willing, we'll be able to get some of Dr. Lyle's time and have him as a guest on a future show.
Yeah, that would be great.
Super. All right, so Fred, could we start with what I think is such a fascinating topic, and it's plants. And how do plants know to grow where they grow? I mean, how does this happen? This is an interesting topic, including when you look at it from the creation versus evolution perspective.
Well, they grow in response to several different external conditions. And, you know, really the most common are gravity, sunlight, and touch. Those are three things that they'll respond to.
Gravity, sunlight, and touch. Now, plants, we think of plants as pretty simplistic as compared to animals. An animal, if it doesn't like what's going on, it gets up and moves away.
That's right. Plants, we kind of take plants for granted.
Yeah, they don't have brains, right? Plants don't have brains. But how is it that a plant knows which way is up when you bury a seed in the ground, whether it happens naturally or when a farmer or a gardener buries a seed 4 feet underground, covers it with dirt? There's no light. And even, you know, just imagine plants are evolving. How do they even know what light is? You know, how do they know what gravity is? But there's no light. So how do they figure out how to grow upward? Because if they started out the first three or four plants that were going to evolve, if they started out growing down, they'd have died, and there would be no plant kingdom.
Yeah, maybe the roots grew up, and we just had roots coming out of the sand.
That's right.
Because how do the roots know to grow down?
The roots grow down, and then the stems grow upward, and the trunks of trees and branches and flowers and all that. And we both know, we've quoted a leading evolutionist who've said that the evolution of flowering plants is an abominable mystery.
Well, how would vegans have evolved?
Vegans, yeah. How would vegans have evolved before plants? And here in Colorado, there's, I think it's a national monument down in Colorado Springs. And I hope to visit it perhaps this summer with my kids. But there's, you could see all these fossils in different strata. And there's a strata sitting on the basement rock of the continent. So it's the very first sedimentary deposit. And Fred, there are trees that were 10 feet in circumference. Trees, 10 feet in circumference. And they're not supposed to evolve for many strata later, hundreds of millions of years. And there they are right at the beginning. It's fun.
I know. They found similar plant life at the bottom of some of the stratas in the Grand Canyon.
That's right. They've found tree pollen down at the Precambrian layer.
That's right. And first published in the Creation Research Society back in the 60s.
Wow, pretty cool. And you're their webmaster. All right, so how is it? There's something called geotropism. Geotropism or geotropism. And phototropism or phototropism. And Fred, these are what enable the plant to grow. Even though the seed is buried in the ground, It grows upward, not downward. And this is just astounding, showing the brilliance of God's engineering skills as our creator.
Yeah, so basically they're cells that can sense gravity, right?
They really are. They're cells. It's almost like you need a gyroscope, right, to keep a submarine upright. Well, cells, they need a way of sensing gravity. And so they have these tiny structures. They have to be tiny because they're inside of cells. And they're called statoliths. Now, lith is an ancient Greek root for stone. So these are statoliths, and they're heavy. And because they're heavy, they sink to the bottom of the cell that they're in. Of course, the cell creates them, makes them. And it's almost like a carpenter gets a plumb line so he can see what's straight and what's plumb. So the cells, the plant needs to grow up. So the cell makes these statoliths. They're very dense, very heavy, and they sink to the bottom of the cell.
Sounds like an arrow to me.
An arrow. Exactly right. And so the cell has the design in it to recognize that because these statoliths sink to the bottom of the cell, the opposite direction is up. And that's how they grow, the stem and all up and the roots down.
And the roots know to grow down.
That's astounding.
It's amazing.
It's so amazing.
How did that evolve?
How did that evolve? Yeah. Right. The sophistication right there is so extraordinary in the multiple parts. And the information system needed to comprehend this. And then once the cell figures out, without a brain, once the cell figures out which way is up and which way is down, then it has to begin to grow its two different parts of its body in those directions.
Well, you know, I just thought of an analogy because, you know, God loves analogies.
Yeah.
So it's like when you and I, or we take our wives to the store mm-hmm. or to the mall.
Mm-hmm.
Aren't they going to go in the direction of like clothing, jewelry,
yeah.
trinkets? We're going to head to Best Buy, the
right.
car toys.
Exactly. The garbage can department. Anything but the clothing and
That's
perfume
right.
and all that. We each have our natural instincts, right, that God has given to us. And so it is truly extraordinary when you think about the abilities that the simplest organisms have, and to call them simple is probably just an artifact of the evolutionary myth.
That's right. They like to use words like simple or archaic to give this illusion of
right.
evolution. But
right.
it's obviously this isn't very simple. In fact, the next thing it talks about is phototropism. That doesn't sound simple.
It doesn't sound simple. And in fact, having cells that can respond to photons is extraordinary. In our human eyes, in our vision system, we have cells that can register a single photon. You turn on a flashlight, and I don't know, over a second, there's got to be a billion or billions of photons coming out of that flashlight in a second. Well, a single photon, it has no mass, and it strikes a cell in your eye, and the cell registers that a photon hit. One photon.
One photon.
That's just extraordinary. So now we have plants. The plants, they don't have a vision system. They don't have a brain to process it. But their phototropism, they respond to light. This is astounding because we all know, if we have observed at all, that plants grow toward light.
I've noticed that.
Yeah.
And so, if you haven't, man, you're not paying attention.
No, you're not. So it turns out that the way God designed plants is that the cells, the plant cells, recognize light. They respond to light. And, of course, photosynthesis, that's how they generate their nutrients, along with water and nitrogen that they get from the ground and all, in the air. And so, Fred, they respond to light. And so the cells that are on the back of the plant or the dark side of the plant, they don't grow at the same rate as the plants on the front side. They become elongated, and that causes the plant, the entire plant, to stretch toward the light.
So it grows faster on the dark side.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Right.
And this is a hormone, of all things, in the plant.
Wow, a hormone telling the plant that the hormone spreads unevenly.
Yeah.
It's like it's a phobia, has a phobia of light striking it. It spreads more rapidly on the dark side.
Which causes it to turn towards the light.
Which, yes. Isn't that something?
That is.
Too bad human beings didn't have more of a phobia to the dark side and turn toward the light.
Yeah, because don't they tend to turn towards the dark?
Yeah, that's right. The Bible says that Jesus came into the world, and the world was filled with darkness, but the darkness did not receive him. He was the light that entered the world, and so we decide whether we'd rather live in darkness, as most people do, tragically, or if we want to turn to the light. He is the light. He says that he is the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father but by him.
Isn't it interesting, if you turn a light in a dark room, darkness flees?
That's right. The darkness flees before the light. The darkness cannot put out the light, but the light vanquishes the darkness.
Exactly.
That is so exciting. And in fact, you know, Fred, that's also a metaphor. It's symbolic of sin and righteousness, because I think C.S. Lewis pointed out, it might have been in his book Mere Christianity, that sin is basically a perversion of something good. It's not as though there is anything wicked in and of itself. It is the goodness that flows from God that is then turned against God or against one another or against ourselves.
Yep. So it does fit that light and darkness analogy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Darkness really isn't a thing, right? It's just the absence of light.
That's right.
It's like cold isn't really a thing. It's the absence of heat.
That's right. And I think those are important concepts. Cold is not a thing. You don't really put cold into something. You take the heat out. And you don't put darkness into something. You remove the light. So when God created the light, he enabled us to comprehend darkness by creating light. But you don't actually create darkness.
Yep.
That's like a figure of speech. All right.
So these plants are also touchy-feely.
They are. So gravity, light, and touch. How do they respond to touch?
Well, you know how vines work, right? Don't they grow up? If you plant a vine near some kind of structure, it'll grow up and attach to it and climb up that structure.
It'll cling, like the Ivy League schools in New England, and vines like the grapevine. And the fruit of the vine, which is a symbol of the blood of Jesus Christ that he sacrificed for us on the cross. And in fact, Fred, you know how Jesus said that you take a seed and you plant it in the ground and you bury it. It's as though it dies, and then it comes up with a new body. A new plant arises, and he used that as a metaphor for his own death and resurrection.
Oh, that's cool.
And he is the creator of that life. So he designed this whole system that we're talking about. So,
and he uses common design, because he uses the same hormone, this thing called auxin, that when one of these plants touches an object, that it produces a lot of this auxin. Same thing, that the cells will grow faster. And so it'll draw plants and produce this clinging effect, and then the vine gradually climbs up the structure.
Yeah. Fred, I was on a nature walk with our kids at Boy Scouts. We are involved with Boy Scouts for the last 6 years or so. And we're doing this nature walk, and it's a guided walk, and we have a tour guide. And we come to a tree, and the tree has, and this is sort of an arid forest type environment, and the tree has its bark that only exists on about a third of the diameter of the tree, but it doesn't just go vertically up a third of the tree. It spirals around the tree. And she said, you know, somebody asked in our group, why does it do that? And she said, you know, I've never found out. And I said, I didn't, you know, they tend to be sort of, they protect their domain, but sort of sheepishly, I said, well, I was reading in a creation journal, and they figured out why it does that. And she's like, oh, why does it do that? And God designed a mechanism during drought in arid times where it's a programmed dieback of the bark, because the bark uses a lot of the tree's water supply. And so if all the bark died, the tree would die. So two-thirds of the bark around the tree die, And then the bark grows and it spirals around the tree as it goes up the trunk, so that no one part of the tree itself will die.
It's completely exposed.
Right. The tree is being protected.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Yeah, isn't it neat? Yeah. It's a designed dieback of the bark for the tree to survive arid conditions and drought. And that shows, again, how brilliant God is. And if there are trees that are supposed to be evolving and there's not enough water, they're going to die. They're not going to survive for thousands or millions of years to create these sophisticated feedback systems.
And you'd think there'd be evidence in the fossil record of this thing evolved from a one-sided bark tree to partially and then finally to the spiral, which even just common sense tells us that that's the most efficient mechanism. If you're going to have one-third of your bark, you make it a spiral up the tree.
Yeah,
you don't go up. You don't go up like, say, 2 feet and then do a square 90-degree.
Right.
Spiral would maximize the efficiency.
The coverage of the limited bark for the entire tree. Isn't it neat? God's design abilities are so extraordinary, and they put us in awe. We stand in awe of our Creator God. If he has that much wisdom and added to the power he needed to create this enormous universe, and then the love he showed by making us and giving, for example, moms love for their children, even while they're still in their womb, those are the kinds of blessings he wants to pour out upon us. But if we turn against him, then it all goes really badly.
That's right. So there's one last thing about these plants, and it's roots. Do they like to seek out rock and try to dig into rock?
Well, roots are fascinating because they go the opposite way of the plants. And Fred, if you could give us the answer to that, let me add this. Scientists are beginning to study plants at the molecular level to see how roots grow. And it turns out it's way more of a drama than they ever dreamed, because plant cells are strong, cellulose.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost like an explosion occurs, a bang out of one side of the plant cell, and it then real quickly builds another cell real quick. And it's so extraordinary, and we're just learning. So even this description I'm giving now is very preliminary, but we're finding out that plants grow in the most extraordinary ways, not what we think we're watching at a superficial level.
Now, that's amazing. It sounds like the cavitation with water, how it can carve through solid rock like butter. You know, people see these big canyons and they think they happen over millions of years. Mm. But scientists know, because of cavitation and the same effect at the very microscopic level where these explosions occur, essentially, and it produces an incredibly powerful mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and Mount St. Helens, we got that fabulous DVD on Mount St. Helens with Dr. Steve Austin. And here's a whole canyon system that was carved out not over millions of years, but in hours and days.
That's right.
Really fun stuff. So, okay, so Fred, tell us about the rocks.
Well, it's called negative thigmotropism. Hmm. And this is where roots use a similar process to grow away from objects they touch in the soil.
Mm-hmm. So that they go around the rocks.
They go around things and
not
more
wanting,
efficient.
Not wanting to expend all that energy trying to knock their brains out, because they don't have any brains. Maybe that's how they lost their brains. Going through the rock, they go around the rock. And I didn't want to answer that because I didn't want to try to have to pronounce that. Negative thigmotropism or tropism. Negative thigmotropism.
So, you know, back to the analogy of the mall, that's like us actually being in our car before we get to the mall. We want to keep driving.
Right.
The wives want to turn in and go into the mall.
Yeah, we have negative thigmotropism.
Yeah, we do.
If I see my kids and they're just doing the same thing over and over, banging their heads against the wall, I'm going to say, son, you need some negative thigmotropism.
And next time my wife says, I don't want to watch that ball game, I'm going to say, you're exuding negative thigmotropism.
So we're ready now for our family. See what you get from Real
Science
Friday? I love thinking about the ecosystem that God made, how there are so many species that help one another. And evolutionists and atheists, they're pretty good at looking at this, Fred. They look and they say, we don't want species to go extinct, because when one species goes extinct, it could hurt a lot of other species. Well, that's true, of course. But God designed our ecosystems to be pretty robust, to where services that are provided, say in the food chain and all, are often redundant. so that two or three or a dozen species provide the same service to other species. Just imagine if evolution were true and you go backward and there's only one species. There's just one reproducing. First of all, there's just one cell, and it's got to provide for all of its needs on its own. How robust of an ecosystem would that be? It's just, it's absurd.
It is absurd.
It's absurd. And then even if it supposedly it reproduced, I mean, that's beyond miracle. That's absurd to happen naturally. And then here is this reproducing species with no other supporters providing it biological services in an ecosystem. It's ridiculous.
It is ridiculous.
Yeah.
So this brings up what we were going to talk about, fire-chasing beetles. It's just another example of design that most people aren't going to be aware of this, but there's beetles that actually seek out areas that have been burnt by a forest fire.
Forest fires.
And it provides a benefit.
Beetles from miles away, from so far away that the smoke is in parts per billion of smoke particles in the air.
Well, the article gave an analogy. It's equivalent to sensing a single drop of a chemical in a 10,000-gallon swimming pool.
So say you're in 10,000 gallons, and somebody dropped, say, one drop of lemon juice into the pool. It's all stirred up.
One drop, yeah.
And you're going to dive in and say, who put the lemon juice in the pool? Imagine this beetle being able to sense or detect a few parts per billion of smoke particles in the air, and then they hightail it to the forest fire. They go to the fire.
They
why
do.
Why do they do?
Well, they got infrared sensors that detect the radiation from the heat.
So not only
do they have multiple ways to detect it.
Infrared sensors to detect the heat, and their detection is so sophisticated that the U.S. Air Force has its scientists researching to see how could they improve their own infrared sensing devices based on this beetle that's called melanophilia. You know, melanin is what causes skin to be dark.
Mm-hmm.
And philia, these are Greek roots for love. So this is a beetle that likes black things because when a forest fire burns, all the bark turns black. And the beetle goes to it and lays its eggs in the freshly burned bark.
Exactly.
And that probably helps the cycle of life because you know how there's a food chain and this great cycle of life and there's a forest fire and now everything has to start all over again. And so you have one of the first creatures are bugs that start to re-inhabit the burned out land.
These guys are just waiting around for a forest fire.
Yeah.
We don't want to encourage people to go burn a forest fire to attract the black beetles.
No.
But they seek these things out and they lay their eggs. Mm-hmm. And they love the smoldering, hot, blackened wood, like you said, and freshly burned. Mm-hmm. That's what attracts them.
And Fred, as you and I once in a while, we talk about our backgrounds. I was a software engineer for McDonnell Douglas Helicopter Company on the Apache AH-64 attack helicopter. And we were in Culver City, California, which was Hughes Helicopters, which was bought by McDonnell Douglas. And I'm sitting in an Apache simulator in a hangar at night. And we open the hangar door and I put on the IHADS, the integrated helmet and display system that normally the pilot would use in a mission. And I'm looking a couple miles away and I see a guy get out of his car, go to his front door of his house, and I could tell he has a cigarette lighter in his pocket.
That's pretty sophisticated.
So the fact that the U.S. Air Force is studying these beetles, it shows, I wonder if they're also studying the monkeys.
Or studying U2.
You remember the Beatles, the rock group, and the monkeys on TV?
Or you remember U2.
Oh, the band. Yeah. So they're studying these beetles because they recognize that the beetles do it better than we can do it.
How many examples do we come across constantly where the military is trying to reverse engineer the ultimate engineer of the universe?
Yeah.
Remember the monarch butterflies? I love that one, the camouflage of the monarch butterflies. So amazing how they bend light, that the military has studied that for their own camouflage.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, not only the military, but every aspect of technology and industry, chemistry, you know, better living through chemistry. Because God is the great chemist, the great mathematician, the great physicist, the great astronomer. He's the great builder. So, Fred, we're almost out of time. But how about the last thing? Could we talk about sharks are warm-blooded?
Yeah, they've got some muscle that's red muscle, and it requires warm blood.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a serious problem because a lot of the temperature of the ocean waters, especially as you go deeper, it's not very warm, is it?
Well, sharks will feed toward the surface, but like you said, as they go deeper, 1,000 meters, 2,000 meters, it goes down to like 39, 42 degrees Fahrenheit. So yeah, it gets very cold. And Fred, it's hard to keep something warm, say when it's cold outside, like a house. It takes a lot of energy, and it's hard to keep something cool when it's hot outside. So warm-blooded creatures, they're not the same temperature as the environment around them, like so many are. Warm-blooded creatures, like human beings, we have to control our core temperature. Otherwise, we die. There's a very narrow range. Fred, I was looking at air conditioners 10 years ago, and a central air conditioner, pretty much the maximum it could do is cool your house by 30 degrees compared to the temperature outside.
So if I'm in Arizona, it's 120 degrees out. I'm lucky if I'm in my house, it's maybe 90.
It's 90 degrees in your house. So if it's 100 outside, it could be 70 if you've got a good air conditioner. Imagine a shark in the ocean. What's harder to protect yourself from, air or water? Water transfers heat like crazy. So just imagine a shark, and how much warmer can a shark be than the water around it?
Up to 38 degrees.
38
degrees. It can be 38 degrees warmer Fahrenheit than the water around it.
That's almost 40 degrees warmer than the frigid water it's swimming in. And it's not doing that with air around it. It's doing that with water, which transfers heat like crazy.
So God wins the Science Project Award again?
Again. God wins the Science Project Award. And the way that sharks do it, it's so fascinating because they do it, they have this a mesh of blood vessels, and they separate the warmer blood from their internal muscles and that red meat muscles to the blood going in the outer parts of the shark's body. And as those two different populations of blood and the meshed blood vessels, as they go by each other, the inner blood does heat up the outer blood, but it protects itself.
That's amazing. And I love they gave the example of the giraffe that has a similar mechanism. And without it, when it puts its head down to get a drink of water, his head could explode.
His head's going to explode. That's right. That's an old Real Science
Friday. We'll talk
Friday
about that
favorite.
Again sometime, the giraffe.
We will. And so God used the same system of the mesh or the network of blood vessels in camels, giraffes, birds, and sharks. Wherever he needed that, that was a brilliant design. And so common design is not evidence of evolution. Evolutionists think that it is. And yet they can't admit that, well, common design is evidence of a common designer.
That's right.
And his name is God.
Hey, so tonight at Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship at Bethlehem Church.
Dr. Carl Baugh.
Yes, 7 o'clock.
From Glen Rose, Texas.
Yep.
7 o'clock tonight, Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship, Wadsworth and 21st.
You got it.
All right, Fred. God bless you. Thanks for another episode.
Thanks, Bob.